This is a BBC podcast. You can get all our podcasts and our terms of use at bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Football on the BBC World Service. I'm Alan Green. The outspoken coach, Raymond Verheyen, hits out at some well-known names in the English Premier League and doesn't hold back when it comes to Manchester United's problems.
I more and more get the feeling that Ferguson appointed somebody so that he could be more or less in charge behind the scenes. Because if Mourinho had been the new manager of Man United, then Mourinho would do it his way.
With the January transfer window bringing its fair share of rumours and horse trading, we spend the day with one of the game's few female agents.
Ex-world champion, he told me, you know, Samira, you are too attractive for this business. If you would be a bit uglier, maybe you could work easier in football business.
And we hear from a footballer from the United States who's playing in Afghanistan.
Someone counted off 1, 2, 3, and I yelled, Ferozi FC! And everyone else yelled, Allahu Akbar! You know, like, God is great. It was an expression of religion for them and me. It was an expression of team spirit. It was just a different take on how to pump yourself up for a game.
But first, the Dutch coach, Raymond Verheyen, has hit out at David Moyes, claiming his, quote, prehistoric methods are responsible for Manchester United's struggling form this season. In 1998, the Dutch manager Frank Rijkaard appointed Verheyen as one of his assistants in preparations for Euro 2000, where the Netherlands reached the semi-final. Verheyen has been involved in every World Cup or European Championship since, working with Russia, South Korea and Australia. His CV also includes spells at Barcelona, Chelsea, Manchester City and the Welsh national team. He believes Alex Ferguson handpicked Moyes so he could keep a certain degree of control at the club. But Verheyen believes it was a poor choice for United because he thinks the new man is stuck in the past.
First of all, in the UK, coaching in general is of a relatively low level. There are many, many coaches who are still training the way they were trained when they were a player 30, 40 years ago. So basically, these days, coaches are still training in an old-fashioned way. And the words prehistoric, and I also use words like Jurassic Park, are words that illustrate the fact that coaches are coaching like people were coaching 40, 50 years ago.
Why do you feel though that Moyes in particular deserves such labels?
Because he's a perfect example of how not to do things.
Can you illustrate that?
Well, in the, let's say, 10 seasons of Everton, Moyes had at least 7 or 8 times a injury crisis in pre-season, resulting in a relatively poor start of the season, and then the team had to catch up in the second half of the season. That is not somebody's opinion, that's a fact. So every journalist who would do his homework could analyze that himself. And then this manager with this patron of the last decade goes to a team that is not only playing in the Premier League but also has to play Champions League. So the game load is going to be even higher than with Everton. And then if you apply the same principles with this team that also has to play Champions League, yeah, you don't have to be Einstein to be able to predict what is going to happen.
Should Sir Alex Ferguson share some of the blame for Manchester United's stuttering season? Moyes inherited a squad that was built by Ferguson.
Yeah, and won the title last year. So there must be something wrong compared to last season. And traditionally, in football, players always get the blame that they are not working hard enough or that they are not committed to the club or thinking about transfers or whatever. But that's too easy. If you appoint somebody who has never won something, who has never coached a Premier League or a Champions League game in his life, then that appointment in itself is a gamble because then somebody is coaching an entirely new situation. So, yeah, they took a risk.
Ferguson handpicked Moyes as his successor. Surely he must believe that Moyes has got what it takes.
Yeah, you would assume that that is correct. Yeah, but looking at the way Moyes has been appointed, with Ferguson calling him, asking him to come to Ferguson's house, and then when Moyes arrives, Ferguson tells him that he is going to be the next Man United manager. And then in the next 5 months, Ferguson is at every single game, except maybe for one or two, overviewing the situation. That I more and more get the feeling that Ferguson appointed somebody so that he could be more or less in charge behind the scenes. And by appointing Moyes, who probably couldn't sleep the night that he was told that he was going to be the next Man United manager, life for Ferguson would be much easier compared to, for example, appointing Mourinho. Because if Mourinho had been the new manager of Man United, then the influence of Ferguson, even behind the scenes, would be almost zero, because Mourinho would do it his way. So I think there is more to the story than people can see from the outside.
Your criticism, Raymond, is in general about English coaching standards. If so many coaches in England are getting it wrong, give us an idea of the coaches who, in your opinion, are actually doing things the right way.
I think that Brendan Rodgers at Liverpool is one of the exceptions on the rule in terms of UK coaches. And a lot has to do with the fact that he travelled the world. He went to Spain, he went to Germany, he went to Holland. So he has a broader perspective. Roberto Martinez at Everton also has a great track record and shows at Everton how to coach football. And also with Wigan and Swansea in the past. So there are definitely good examples as well, but these, unfortunately, are more exceptions to the rule.
The Dutch coach, Raymond Verheyen. Now to the drama of the January transfer window. So far, the biggest signing has been Juan Mata's move from Chelsea to Manchester United. AC Milan have also been busy, adding the Japanese international Keisuke Honda and Michael Essien to their squad. But as we get down to the final day, hours and minutes, things can get a bit frantic. Paul Duffin is the former chairman of Hull City.
As the time guillotine starts to fall at the end of the window, you're in a situation where it becomes physically impossible for medicals to be conducted on the last day of the window. And this is where you're sometimes clearly subject to a certain amount of risk. And there was one wonderful occasion when such a situation occurred. A player turned up. There wasn't time for a medical. We had concerns over his publicly known medical history. The club physio was reluctant to make a call without having a proper conversation with the guy at the other end. So we left the agent and the player in the room whilst we went out to consult, and the club physio tries to get hold of his counterpart. We come back with a slightly qualified opinion, walk back in the room to find they've both hightailed it, understanding that we were ambivalent, and they've driven to a club down the road where he signed that same evening. So it's quite incredible, and this comes to the whole pressure, the risk-reward decision that clubs have to make.
The former chairman of Hull City, Paul Duffin, explaining some of the potential pitfalls when trying to get those last-minute deals done. So what about the often maligned agents? Samira Samiyi is one of the few female football agents working in Europe. Her most famous client at the moment is the Tunisian international and Hertha Berlin attacker Sami Alagui. But she also works closely with Lothar Matthäus, Andreas Bremer and Per Mertesacker. World Football's Money Jasmine spent the day with her in Munich to find out what life is like for agents in January and what it's like to be a woman in a male-dominated industry.
2007, I tried to help Arminia Hanover. Many people know me from this moment, so I want to build my own business. And I said to Football World, here I am. So now you can fight with me. So, okay, I'm hearing really loud my music. Now I have to drive to Bayern Munich. I have a meeting because of some young talent.
So tell me about your job. What do you do as a football agent?
The first important thing is negotiation. Make the contract longer and find a club for our player. We have also the young player coming in the foreign country, and you have to support them in the daily life. They have family. You have to support the family, help them to find an apartment, to make an insurance, or you know, when they're coming to the foreign country, they don't know the culture and tradition. You have to show them. So as a player agent, you have big responsibility for your client.
Do you think it helps you to be attractive?
It can be dangerous. Can be easier for my job. Sure, when you're attractive, and you know, I like to wear elegant and high heels, so it's easier to have a conversation with the business partner, but you have to show the people this limit, this distance, then they cannot break this limit. We have a business relationship, not more.
Have people tried to take advantage of you then in the past?
Sometimes, yes. Young player, they want to try more, or they hope more. The manager, after the business meeting, they hope to have a lunch or dinner with you. But depends how professional you are. You know, Mani, I have to call the friend of mine, Stefan Reuter. He was a world champion in 1990. So if it doesn't disturb you, I will call him.
No, please.
Die gewählte Rufnummer ist besetzt. Wenn Sie eine Rückrufbitte.
It's a busy time.
It's a busy, but I will try again. Okay. Yeah, now is a busy time because now is a winter transfer. Whole day phone conversation, many appointments, travel a lot.
Hello.
Hi Ben, this is Samira.
Hello, Samira. How are you doing?
How are you? I'm doing fine.
I'm fine too, thanks.
Do you have any news regarding this guy from the Spain?
Yes, I have very good news for us.
Tell me.
They give us an offer for our player.
We have some soccer player from Spain, so we got in Kuwait the offer for him. I sent an email to the Kuwait, but I didn't know if they want or not. And finally, they sent my Scott, and they have seen the YouTube and all the film, and they are happy. So we have to fly now to Kuwait to fix the contract. Sure, we have to handle about the salary and everything.
An official offer.
I will have a good weekend because of this news. Thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. In the Arabic country and the Middle East, I was really surprised they accept and they respect me as a business partner, as a female agent, more than the modern country like Germany. Germany is really famous for his football, but still now the people thinking in cliché. I hear many times these macho claims and this male egoism. One of the famous manager of Bundesliga, he told me, Samira, I will buy a player from you if you shoot the ball in the wash machine with your 40 centimeter high heels. Maybe it's funny, but of the other side means he doesn't accept me as a business partner. Ex-world champion, he told me, you know, Samira, you are too attractive for this business. If you would be a bit uglier, maybe you could work easier in football business.
No.
He has to be available, he promised me. I told you before, if I said I was okay, maybe he's not available. If I want to get something, I make the people so long like this.
Till you wear them down. Until...
No, let me. Okay, Samira, what do you want?
Stefan,
hi, Stefan, this is Samira. Wie geht's?
Yeah, sehr gut, sehr gut. Entschuldigung, ich habe schon gemeldet.
What's your long-term aim? What's your ultimate goal?
Everyone has a dream. I have also a dream, maybe one day be a manager of the Bundesliga club. As a director manager for a football club.
And is that achievable? Is that realistic here?
I mean, why not? We have also Angela Merkel. She's managed our country as a woman. Why me as a female agent cannot manage the club? Wir hören uns einfach im Februar nochmal.
Vielen Dank, ich freue mich.
Okay, bye, Stefan. Bye, ciao.
Thank you, bye, bye.
So she finally got her man. That's the 1990 World Cup winner, Stefan Reuter, ending our day with agent Samira Samiyi. You're listening to World Football on the BBC World Service with me, Alan Green. The Juventus defender, Stefan Lichtsteiner, has told World Football that the current Switzerland team is the best the country's ever had. The Swiss were unexpectedly seeded in the draw for the World Cup, and Lichtsteiner is confident that their multicultural squad will be a match for anybody in Brazil. Lichtsteiner has played 60 times for his country, and he joined Juventus in 2011, winning two consecutive league titles. Juventus are well on course for more success this season, despite suffering an upset in the Champions League. But Lichtsteiner already has an eye on the World Cup, where the Swiss will face Honduras, Ecuador and France in the group stage.
I'm thinking about because I'm ready for the World Cup, but I'm not. I don't know now how they play. We are the points that we can maybe profit for do good things, but I'm ready for the World Cup. I'm thinking sometimes on the World Cup, but for me the first priority is now Juventus. We want to win again the Scudetto. It's difficult with a very good Roma this year, and also in Europa League we want to go in a final.
But the professor, if you can call him that, Ottmar Hitzfeld, he will already be making plans. What kind of man is he?
Yeah, he won everything. He's a big coach because he has on his visit card, he has like, I don't know how many titles, 25, two Champions League, everything. He won everything. But he's also, as a person, really, really good, correct and hard.
Your team, the Swiss team, is the most cosmopolitan team at the World Cup. It's incredible. Okay, so let me give you some names, okay? These are not Swiss names. Gavranovic, Inler, Xhaka, I think you say, Djemaili, Seferovic, Derdiok, Joru. This is amazing. I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, but it's not a problem because everybody speaks more than two languages in Switzerland. Of course, you said now so many names, like also Shaqiri, and this part of the country in Switzerland, because the people come to us, we give them a chance that they can do well in our country. Then, of course, now we see a national team with so many names different, but I think it's the national team with the most quality that the Switzerland has ever seen.
And some people say that this team can teach something to society. I don't know if you see that. Do you understand that? Because everybody from so many different countries coming together, being one team, people can learn something from that.
Yeah, of course, because I think it's important to learn also the other mentalities, because also me, I'm out from 9 years now from Switzerland, and I went to France, I came to Italy, and it's important that you see the mentality. You learn the mentality also, and at the end you see that this is not a problem. Of course, a Swiss guy is completely different than an Italian guy. But if you take the positive points, you will find every time a good time to live together. And in Switzerland, it's no problem with all the people that come in Switzerland.
Looking at your group, France is a team that at the moment can be beaten. They didn't qualify too easily. Now, if we just look at, like all football fans do, they try to work out what's going to happen. Their team is going to play this team. If you come second in the group, you're going to play Argentina. But if you come first, Iran, Nigeria, or Bosnia, to win that group is so important. You don't want to play Argentina in the next round.
why not? It's also possible to win. I think for sure we want to arrive first, because after it's a little bit easier. But even if you arrive second, it's not played against Argentina, because this team is really strong. We won against Germany, we won against Brazil in the last friendly game at home. We are really able to do good. We won 1-0 against Spain on the World Cup, on the last World Cup, and now we are really better than before 4 years. And in the football, never the games are never finished before that. It's not really finished from 90 minutes.
What's your favourite World Cup memory? One moment, does it stand out for you? It doesn't have to be about Switzerland, it can be anything.
It's difficult to say, but for sure that we won 1-0 against Spain after we went out against Honduras. You see, and it's like on the balls, you know, once 100% up and once 100% down. But that's a little bit of also the qualities that we didn't have 4 years ago.
Stefan Lichtsteiner talking to Adnan Nawaz. Finally, there are many things for modern footballers to worry about, but few have the added pressure of trying to avoid suicide bombers and being kidnapped by terrorists. But that's been a real concern for Nick Pugliese, an American playing in Afghanistan's professional league. Pugliese plays for Ferozi FC in Kabul, earning $300 a month. He initially moved to Afghanistan to work for a telecommunications company, but he gave up the steady job to follow his dream of playing professional football. World Football's Matthew Nelson met up with Nick to find out why the midfielder has been putting himself in potential danger to play soccer.
My name is Nick Pugliese. I'm from Rochester, New York. I just returned to the US from playing professional soccer in Kabul, Afghanistan. Afghanistan is a soccer-loving country, and a lot of my Afghan co-workers at my telecom job played on the weekends. And so after a few months of being there and hearing them talk about, you know, we had X and Y result this past weekend, you know, I sort of like, you know, can I play? Will you let me come out? And they said, sure, why not? You know, just come this Friday morning to this field across the city and we'll welcome you, no problem. Like in any park, there aren't hard and fast rules. A lot of times, you know, I mean, goals can be called into question or just outright ignored if you're dealing with a team that's older or more powerful. You know, you have sort of the local thugs that even if they get scored on, they're not going to come off. So you're constantly negotiating these sorts of characters. You have some good players, some bad players, kids from all different backgrounds, men, children, drug addicts, you know, guys carrying knives. I mean, you had a little bit of everything.
How do you play a soccer game carrying a knife?
People have pockets. I mean, and they're not running with it or anything, but you know they probably are packing some sort of protection.
So you transitioned from these sort of pickup games to earning a professional contract. How did that come about?
Yeah, so one of my co-workers also happened to play for the club called Ferozi Football Club, or Ferozi FC. And after he saw that I can play in these amateur games on Friday morning, he said, you know, why don't you come and try out for a professional team? And so he contacted the coach. He said, I've found a neat player. He happens to be American, and he wants a run with the team. So a couple weeks later, I showed up at Ghazi Stadium, which is the central stadium in Kabul. And for 2 weeks, 3 days a week, I had a run with this team. They liked what they saw, and they offered me a contract.
Was there any hesitancy on your part when it came to signing on? I mean, you were making a good living in your previous job and you had the security of living inside a safe compound. Was it a difficult choice to make?
Rationally, there was quite a bit of hesitancy. I called my mother and mentioned this idea to her, and she was not too thrilled with the prospect of, you know, me leaving this comfortable job and pursuing my passion for soccer. In terms of outright animosity on account of my being American, I rarely saw that. People were more interested in talking about soccer than about politics. Across the board, my being American really didn't generate too much animosity. If anything, it was a matter of curiosity and interest.
Tell me about what it's like on match day in Afghanistan. Were there rituals or routines any different to what you'd experienced previously?
Yeah, so when I played for my university team in the States, before the game, we'd say, 1, 2, 3, Williams College, right? 1, 2, 3, Williams. And during my first game for Ferozi FC, I assumed it would be analogous. So I said, you know, someone counted off 1, 2, 3, and I yelled, Ferozi FC. And everyone else yelled, Allahu Akbar, you know, like, God is great. It was sort of a religious, it was an expression of religion for them and me. It was an expression of team spirit. It was just a different take on how to pump yourself up for a game.
Finally, Nick, when your friends ask you about your time playing soccer in Afghanistan, what's the one story that you always tell them?
The one story has to be winning the Kabul Cup tournament back in May. It was my first tournament with Ferozi FC, and in the finals we scored a goal in second half stoppage time to send it to overtime and then to PKs. And in penalty kicks, I didn't even take a penalty kick, but my teammates pulled it out 5-4, and being a part of that group pileup was something I'll never forget. It's a sports cliche. It happens everywhere in the world, and for that reason it was even more meaningful to me to be just another member of this team in Afghanistan, to be right in the middle of the group pileup. That was a really special time. I mean, from a soccer standpoint, everyone wants to win. Sports mean the same thing across the globe. And from a human standpoint, I felt in that sort of moment that there was a common essence, in this case among soccer players, but just among people. People want to be happy. They want to succeed together. I mean, it's so simple. I think that's the lesson. It's so simple.
That's Nick Pugliese, an American playing in Afghanistan. That's all for this week. Remember, if you want to download World Football, just go to our website. That's bbcworldservice.com/worldfootball. You can also follow us on Twitter @WSWorldFootball. Join us again at the same time next week. Until then, always remember, World Service, World Football.